Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 70. Nothing to laugh about with episode 70, Gary. We're going to be serious, mature adults going into the new year. Episode 70 of Run to the Hill, sponsored by Cheer Charge. A happy belated Christmas.
Yeah, belated Christmas.
Mary, how are you? How was the festive time for you?
Oh my goodness, I love the festive time. Just a time to spend. Lots of lying, going to bed late, your kind of body clock shifts. Oh, yeah, dangerous. Just family time. I really enjoy it. I had my dad round for Christmas dinner. That was nice. And he spent the full day. My, you know, pensioner parent gets itchy feet quite quick. He has his food, has a beer, and then he wants to go home. But no, he spent had a little snooze and watched Home Alone 2, I think it was. Just classic. Lovely Christmas time.
Turkey and all the trimmings?
Well, he tricked me dad. Yeah, because there's only him that was the meat eater, really, out of all of us. So I bought a packet of roast chicken. I wasn't going to buy a big turkey to cook and waste. He didn't realise he was eating chicken, so that was good. Passed the test.
We're never listening to this, Gary, going, yeah. I was promised turkey.
Yeah, passed the test. We had some kind of veggie Wellington, and I think I was pouring scorn on it last week. It was really nice. I can't complain, but just lovely time. I really enjoy that time when everyone's together. There's no refreshing your inbox and an email pops up you've got to respond to or anything like that. It's just a nice time.
If somebody sends you something, they don't expect a response.
Yeah.
It all goes quiet, the pressure goes, you don't know what day it is, you don't know what time it is.
I love that, yeah.
Just in a calorie-induced wet.
I'm still going through the Spanish chocolate, it's great.
Stop it. How much did you buy?
Well, I bought quite a lot, yeah.
any running? Did you train on Christmas Day? What's your...
I only started training yesterday, so everything else. I'm just doing the same loop of the village.
There he goes again. Is that Gary again?
Yeah. People barely see me unless I'm in my shorts. It's quite unusual. People actually comment if they see me in jeans. It's like, oh, I've never seen you not in your shorts. But yeah, just doing that. And then yesterday, I did my first workout. Neil and I did our 200s and 400s. And I mentioned to you offline, it's quite a different sensation to a threshold run or something like that, or even a long, slow run. I had this like, even just last night and this morning, there was some definite fatigue. And it wasn't a huge session. It was 4 200s, 6 400s, then 4 200s. Or like trying to get into heart rate zone 4. So it's quite quick. You're trying to get up there quite quick. Pace was way off. I wasn't so happy with that. But yeah, different workout altogether. And Neil is such a star. Honestly, I'm kind of really feeling sorry for myself. It's not as fast as I was, Neil. I'm a bit heavier than I used to be. I'm older, but Neil's always throwing positives back at me. He's not, he'd be a great football manager. I've said this to him before, actually.
Or a politician.
Yeah. He's such a wonderful guy to go out running with, though. He's really positive. Lots of sleep. And when I was editing Dean's interview for this week's show, we felt really lazy because Dean was up at kind of 3 or 4 in the morning and bashing out a marathon before the rest of us wake up.
I've bashed out a few 5Ks before anything else.
Yeah.
That's about my limit. Oh, I need to get back then.
So yeah, back training now. These sessions are quite big. This Jack Daniels thing I'm on, like warm up, cool down, and the session was about 8-9 miles, I think, last night. And then tomorrow's session, it's 5 times 1 mile. I've established it's a mile, not a kilometer. And then finishing off with some 200s with a minute rest off each mile. So that is quite spicy. Yeah. And it's going to be quite rolling. I'm going to run to Durham, meet everyone there and go to the cinema. So that's my plan. That's the plan anyway.
Imagine the recovery snacks you can have at the cinema.
Yeah, it's going to probably fall asleep, actually.
Oh, you're going to put those hamstrings and you're going
to
sit in those.
Whoever sits next to me has got the short straw. When I'm stinking of BO in the cinema.
You stink, you'll be snoring and you won't share your snacks.
Yeah. Oh, if you've ever been, you want to be in Durham Cinema, but it's got recliners, so you can put
I have been to Durham Cinema, but it's probably popular now. Yeah, then... pretty sure it's like a really old school. I'm pretty sure we used to go to Newcastle if we were going to go to the cinema.
Last time I was in Durham Cinema, the old Durham Cinema, I would have been doing some heavy petting on the back rows.
Stop it! Spoiling the seat.
The new one is it's really nice. How about you then, Eddie? What's your Christmas been like?
I haven't been soiling any seats. No. Oh yeah, it's been the same as yours. Really quiet but lovely. We had the most lovely Christmas day, quiet, and we had this really cold spell before Christmas where I literally was losing a year of my life every time I did any exercise outside, and my hands were just hurting and I was getting that like knuckle chapping just from being outside, just from going, just doing everyday stuff. It was just every time you went outside you were like, had to dress up so warm. It was just constantly like between like minus 10 and minus 15 all the time.
It
was making me weary, and it was the kids were like getting up, if they were on the early morning ski slot, they were heading out up to like 2,000 meters, and I was thinking, oh my god, it must be so cold up there. They were anyway. So we didn't Christmas Day. The temperature warmed up and started to rain, unfortunately, which then washes away the snow and makes everything just this ice, literally. Ooh. Step out of our front door and it's just slick ice. But I got a voucher for ASICS from my Santé Leon, because it was sponsored by ASICS.
Oh, yes.
And I purchased some trainers, which I've always wanted to do for this. I think this is our seventh winter here. And I've always been too tired and been like, no, it'll be fine, I'll just carry on running. Anyway, I purchased these ASICS trainers, which have got built-in tiny little cross-country spikes in.
Oh, wicked, yes.
And it's a total game changer. I mean, why have I not worn these for the whole 7 years? Not only can I run on ice, but I can just run on, even on like the piece of tracks, it gives me just that little bit of grip so that I'm not, even though I didn't really feel like I was slipping. Anyway, I digress. But anyway, it's been really, really icy. And so, but now I've got those and I was coming down, I had the most gorgeous run. Must have been 2 days ago because it's been raining since then. And it was my first, it was exactly a month since my big race. And I finally felt, I did an hour. I wasn't tired. I loved it. I wanted to be out there. I was full of running and there was nobody out there. And I've got this bit where I turn, finish the uphill. Because basically I run all uphill in the winter, one direction, turn around and run downhill. There's no undulations. It's just like 45 minutes uphill, turn around, run down. Anyway, I got 3/4 of this winter loop and I turned to come down. And then as I turn to come down, I run through like this arch of trees and I can see down the valley for miles and miles and miles. And I was like, I'm ready. I'm ready to train again. I'm ready to be fresh. And I had this grip on my trainers and I was running so fast. And these snowshoers, which always makes me laugh, were coming up like dressed as if they're going to the Arctic, and I'm out in just like leggings and the trainers. And they didn't know I had my spikes on. So I was hurtling down what was quite icy. And they were like, oh my God, run so fast on this. I was like, underneath I've got like these nails sticking in.
Awesome.
Anyway, I've used Christmas to boost my calories and finally feel like I'm ready. Now I'm chomping. Now I'm getting that little bit of slight irritation because I'm ready to, I want to start training now.
Ooh, okay.
I feel like, oh, come on, I'm ready. Where's my plan? But I've done.
Let me get a false start. Sometimes I think I'm ready.
I've had that for the last few weeks. So I've thought, I'm ready. And then I've done the odd bit and been like, I've done a big ski. I set myself a little challenge. So I dropped one of the kids at ski training and then I had dropped him at 8:45 and I had till 11:45. And I've got this one piece, which I do repeatedly. And I was like, I've done it twice, many times. I was like, I'm going to see if I can do it 3 times in the time he's training. And I literally, you can't speed. I couldn't stop. I saw a mate and I was like, no, I've just got to go, go, go. Got to the top, get back down again. Go, 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 go. Literally, I did not stop. And I did the third lap. I think I did the first one in like 46 minutes. Yeah. Second one in 47, third one in 48. And I died on the third one. I was like hanging. My legs felt like they were going to fall off.
That's a good
Massive workout that, because you just, the skis, yeah, it was hard. And, but I had to, I was like, okay, I've got to be down there at 11:45. And it was like 11:34. And I wasn't quite at the top. And I was like, I can't bonk. I've got to just get to the top. Anyway, as I came down the bottom of the piece and went around the corner, Finley skiing down the front face, going, we met. And I was like that. But I was, then I was just ruined. I was just ruined. And he was like, oh my God, quick, you know, lunch. And I'm like, oh my God, I need to lie down. I'm like 3 hours. I haven't stopped. But I have been, yeah, I've been so grateful. Tim sent us some cheer charge bars just before Christmas.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
Those protein 20 gram ones, they are solid. The smaller ones are so great for training, but those 20 gram protein ones are like a block of a nugget.
I've got to be careful though, because I could just smash a lot of those.
I could just with a cup of tea. But I feel like they're an anytime snack. There's that amount. You know, everyone needs that bit of protein.
It's perfect timing though, because we just had this chat and I've got the kind of sense that you weren't so happy that I didn't really recover properly after the run with my lack of protein intake. And then ta-da, I had all these protein bars.
So I've been, yeah. And then the last thing I was doing that was any interest to anybody is, yeah, a bit more gym work. I feel so much stronger already. I feel when I go to lift the weight that it's there. So I'm really pleased I've done like the 4 weeks of like preload.
Yeah.
I've done a couple of like little, because the weather's been so shite. I've done a couple of little treadmill uphill sessions just to get, because I know Coach John is going to set me some heat within a week. It'll be like 2,000 meters, easy cruise, uphill treadmill. Oh my God. So I've just been initiating that pain that's coming and the calf muscles. And already I'm like, oh, I can feel that gym work in the glutes. Quite happily, I can see how people get addicted to going to the gym. Yeah, I feel I'm excited to see where, how that will make me, you know, stronger, more resilient, and how that will translate in training. I think once I back up into my training volume, perhaps I won't enjoy it quite so much, because I'll be like,
some you do, some you don't. When's your first, like, maybe obviously not your ear race, but when's your first kind of event to focus on?
So I'm going to do a little trail race, a 35K at the end of April. I think that's my first. And then I've got to find something May. I might come over. I saw there was South Downs Way 50K in May, which ties in with the kids' holidays and me coming over. So I might do that. And then Lavaredo end of June. So yeah, I want to find something like 60, 70, not too much, so it doesn't take too much recovery.
Yeah.
In between, around May time, to be honest, I haven't put a lot of effort into it before Lavaredo. But I won't do any running races until April, because that gives me January, February, and March to...
Yeah, good build.
Good ski, build the legs. So, talking of Christmas, did Santa visit?
He did, actually. Got lots of nibbles, like the old nibbles. We've done a lot of... You kind of talked about, you know, you and Brian, you kind of buy yourself stuff. Yeah, so we've done a bit of that. But my totally unexpected, my favorite, well, I got a massive tin, the kind of camping mugs that you get, but it was a Moomin one. So it was a proper finish. Yeah, lovely. But it makes it look like you've not got much beverage. It's a two cup, it's a two mug. It's massive. Yeah, it's a good one. I think I did that picture when I was having my coffee and my cheer charge, but it literally, that was the same amount of coffee.
About that coffee? What was that coffee? it was like black with like a China. It looked like the water hadn't been boiled properly. It was like half full and there was no milk.
Oh yeah, no milk in me.
Are you French?
Yeah, straight for no milk.
No milk.
No, black. I think a nice little bit of sugar in there. But yeah, we're going off topic here.
I'm just so disgusted. So if you had tea, would you have black tea?
No, I wouldn't actually. No. I don't know why I have black coffee actually. Just, you know, probably going back to the days when I didn't really have a healthy approach to food and I was trying to minus out calories left, right, and center. Yeah, big, lovely Moomin one. What my favorite present was, I got some Tyrannosaurus Rex Christmas socks. And I just really wasn't expecting them. You know, the kids did like a Secret Santa and give them a bit of money and off they went. And came back with a mug and some socks. It was wonderful. Really, really lovely. How about yourself?
Oh yeah. I got my first time, my eldest went off and bought me a Christmas present, had it wrapped. And I got a lovely mug too. Aren't we sad, Gary?
I love a mug.
I love a mug. And he was so proud and he went and got it from under the tree. And then he's like, and it had dogs on it. And, you know, that looks like Lindy and that looks like Tarka. And Mum, it's quite big because I know you like quite big mugs. And this was a general workout theme to my present, some nice leggings. I mean, I don't often buy myself trainers, but I don't buy like kit as in like a pleasurable. So both my sisters had bought me some new leggings for our lady list, or maybe the gentleman, some really nice, they're not Lululemon, but they're like Lululemon leggings, nice high waist, really super comfy, nice colours, brighten it up. There's nothing like a bit of motivation to get outside when you've got a new bit of kit.
New kit, yeah, it's lovely.
Go to nobody, apart from the dogs and the rain. And I did get a present from Bryn, even though I said, don't buy me anything. I got some, to go with my supersonic skis and boots, some supersonic light poles. Ooh. They're Leki for all our trail runners that use, but they're skiing ones. And the best bit about them is that at the bottom, my old touring poles are just like a normal, like I'd say like a trekking pole for walking that has got a little spike on the end. But these ones look like they're an ice axe on the bottom.
Ooh, okay.
Because sometimes when you're going, not sometimes, many times when you're going uphill on the skis, and it's icy, you literally are holding on to move the ski up. You dig the pole in. If you lose the pole and it doesn't dig in, if it's really icy, you fall backwards. And it's a truly horrible sensation.
Yeah.
Because the ski doesn't stick and you go back. And you get that back. But when you fall, it's really nasty. But these ones are a lot proper, like, I'm getting that pole in to get those skis up, and they're super light, I look super cool. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to look really good with all the gear.
It sounds like you're doing well. It's quite high risk, isn't it, buying an athlete some kit because it might not be correct. But yeah, it sounds like you did well there.
I may have pointed him in the right direction with the link and the payment.
Just add to basket, Bryn.
I've bought it. Just give me the box when the postman
results. It's been quite tricky, actually. I suppose it is Christmas. There's not a load of things going on, but I spotted two fell races. Apologies. There's probably loads of things going on that I've missed, but there's two fell races. And one's fell. Would it be one's fell race, or would it be one's fell race?
Oh, what a silly question. I don't know.
Sorry. Well, it just... but anyway, Bailey Cartwright from Matlock Harriers took the win in 1944, and a previous guest, great to see her cushion it, Sarah McCormack from Ambleside AC, which is pretty close to once fell in 22 minutes and 54 minutes. I've been at once fell and...
Fell? How was it?
Fell.
Did you fall?
No, I didn't fall, but it's you go in Ambleside, you think, oh yeah, we'll go up there. You can kind of see it. I think there's a bit of a false summit, and you take the kids up, and within about 10 minutes, they weren't happy. And I'm like that. You know, when you're running with somebody and they're half stepping, just kind of dragging you along. Well, I'm that dad, 10 meters ahead.
Come on, you'll like it when you're up there.
Yeah.
We'll have sandwiches at the top.
We had a lovely pack lunch at the top.
It's always worth it. They're always fun once they get going. It's always an initial 10 minutes moaning, and then they realise they've got to go up, and then they're fine. The Chevin Chase. This reminds me a bit of we watched the National Christmas Lampoon Vacation.
Oh, classic.
Oh, my God. Absolute classic. Joe Hudson won in 38 minutes, 31 seconds, and then we wanted to read out second place, which was Jonathan Brownlee in 39 minutes 15 seconds, because we thought Joe needed a shout out for beating a Brownlee brother. And then another triathlete, Georgia Taylor Brown, won in 45 minutes, two Olympians in that race. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, awesome. But imagine beating an Olympian. Oh my God, I wouldn't stop telling people that.
Imagine the Instagram post.
yeah, awesome. Well done, everybody. This week's guest is none other than ultra marathon man himself, Dean Karnassus. You know, this was a massive treat. It took a long time. Nobody was being, you know, it was just trying to get everybody to be in the same place at the same time. That's all it was. But it did take a long time to get the interview.
And we had to read the book.
I'm yet to read the book, but I'm not going to lie, I was mega nervous for this one.
We were both mega nervous. Do you think you can tell? You've edited it.
Well, yeah, you let us know, listeners, if you can tell how scared we were. But Dean was a gen. He gave up a lot of time for us. And I think it was an early morning for him, but that's nothing new for Dean. But yeah, I had a blast. Pushing past the nerves. I did really enjoy it. It was a real treat. From somebody, you know, I remember being introduced to Dean Karnas's book from a friend from Sedgefield Harriers. And that was a big catalyst, much more than say Feet in the Clouds or Born to Run. For me, that Ultramarathon Man was the first book that really kind of opened my eyes to this world of ultra running. So this was a real, real treat for me. Hope you enjoy it.
We are thrilled to welcome Dean to Run to the Hills podcast this week. Probably like 99% of us listening, we were inspired to dip our toes into ultra running after reading his first book, Ultra Marathon Man. Dean is an internationally acclaimed endurance athlete, Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world, and is now back with his new book, A Runner's High. I thought I would describe it as it's not a sequel, it's not a comeback book, but it's about his journey into a new realm. One of us, a lot of us, Gary and I especially, finding ourselves in as we get older, wiser, and perhaps not physically faster, but mentally stronger. And it's all about how he uses that strength to his own advantage. So Dean, hi, welcome to the podcast. How are you? Where are you? And have you been for a run today?
So I'm doing pretty well. That's how I'm doing. Where am I? I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, a place called Marin County. So just north across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And have I gone for a run today? Yes.
You'd have disappointed me if you'd said no. I'd have been like, well, can you just pretend?
I get asked that question so many times on interviews that I've learned that if you get shamed if you don't go for a run. So I just force myself to go for a run.
Yeah. No, don't say that. what sort of time of day is it with you when we're recording now?
Yeah, it was a morning run. So for me, you guys, it's your evening, and I think we're 8 hours behind you. So it's just coming up on noon.
Have you been to San Francisco, Eddie?
Nope. Seen it in loads of movies. I guess that's what everyone says too. I know the bridge from movies.
You got to come run here. It's pretty magical. It's one of the few cities, and I travel all around the world. It's one of the few cities where, you know, literally 10 miles away from downtown, you can be in a forest. A legitimate forest. Yeah.
It is. Oh my goodness me. It must be. Wowzers. About 18 years ago, we went to San Francisco. I sold my property and jumped on a plane and back traveled around the world, and we ended up in the States. And I don't like to regret many things, really, but I wasn't really a runner then. And yeah, now I could have done some serious exploring. Like you say, the Golden Gate Bridge, then going over the bridge and all the redwoods, if my memory is correct. Phenomenal, phenomenal place. But it's not flat. I wouldn't really like to live in the kind of downtown San Francisco. It'd be a bit of a struggle. Now, most of our listeners, they'll have read your book, Ultramarathon Man, me included. But for our listeners who maybe have missed it for some reason, could you tell us how you got into the crazy world of ultra running?
I blame it all on bad alcohol. So, yeah. I used to love to run when I was a kid. I mean, my earliest childhood recollections are running home from kindergarten when I was 5 years old. And I ran competitively when I was in high school, and we won the cross country championships. And I kind of thought that's as far as I'll take my running. And I decided that running was boring at that point. You know, I had better things to do with my time than to be running. And so I stopped running at 15, stopped running altogether. And then flash forward to my 30th birthday, I was in San Francisco, you know, at a pub, at a nightclub, you know, doing a lot of people do on their 30th birthday. I was drinking with my buddies, and at midnight I told them I was leaving, and they said, "Well, where are you going? It's your 30th birthday. Let's have another round of tequila to celebrate." And I said, "No, I'm going to run 30 miles to celebrate instead." And they looked at me and they said, but you're not a runner. You're drunk. And I said, I am, but I'm still going to do it. So I literally walked out the door, and I'll never forget this. I didn't even own running gear, but I had on these comfortable silk underwear, these, you know, silk boxer shorts.
Classic.
So I just took off my pants. I didn't know what else to do. I took off my pants. I threw them down the alleyway.
Yeah.
And I started stumbling off into the night, going south. And I knew that there was a city called Half Moon Bay that was 30 miles away. And I thought, no, I'd just run there. And I sobered up about, you know, 10 miles down the road. And I thought, what are you doing? This is the most ridiculous thing a human could be doing, but it just felt right. I mean, I was out in the middle of nowhere at that point, so I couldn't really turn around.
Yeah.
And the moon was out and the stars were shining. You know, all those things that we love when we run an ultra marathon now.
Yeah.
I experienced all of that, and it just captivated me. And I somehow made it 30 miles. You know, I ran all night. And it wasn't pretty. There was some blistering and chafing.
Chafing, I was going to say.
Lots of chafing, yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of chafing. But that night forever changed the course of my life.
You talk a little bit, even though your first book is entitled Ultramarathon Man, that you're a bit uncomfortable being called that. And obviously you are called it a lot at races, and you cringe a bit, and your dad, you could talk about your dad calling it. Why do you feel that you are uncomfortable with that term when it embodies actually who you are?
Yeah, it was funny. It was a reporter that gave me that title. So she just thought that was an appropriate title for the story she was writing about me, and ended up being on the cover of a pretty influential magazine, and it just stuck. But I think, you know, those are pretty big shoes to live up to. The ultra marathon man, like, oh, you know, who is this guy? And, you know, I've always felt a little uncomfortable with that title. I think, you know, some people probably think I came up with it and it's kind of like chest pounding, but the reality is I didn't come up with it. And I get a little embarrassed when people call me that, especially my dad.
Yeah.
I think your dad, it sounds like your dad loves it. That's what that's the best bit of being a parent, isn't it? It's embarrassing.
Yeah, I love that. The early parts of the book, I really enjoyed that. Your dad embarrassing you.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, we're both grown men now and he still embarrasses me like I'm, you know, I'm still in high school or something. But that dynamic never goes away. I'm glad you enjoyed the runner's high because, you know, it's storytelling, as you know. Yeah. I mean, it is about running, but it's also a broader story than that. It's about family. It's about, you know, life pursuits, how to live your best life.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of themes that are all interwoven. And I think a runner can, you know, you guys, I hope you're nodding your head at some point agreeing with some of the things I was saying, because I think there's a lot of unique feelings and thoughts and emotions mm-hmm. that runners experience. I mean, we're a little bit different than normal folk in that, you know, we seek out difficult things. We're comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's kind of counterintuitive to how most people live their lives.
I look at a trail or a mountain and I just want to go there. I really do. It's sometimes it's tough and the weather can't be kind all the time. But yeah, like I say, I just see a summit and just wonder, what's it like? What's it like at the top of there? But I loved it, you know, especially the early part of the book. It really did feel like a buddy movie, a road trip. It was a really kind of warm experience between you and your dad. I really did enjoy that.
I think you talk very honestly, perhaps a little bit more than in the first book, about the relationship that you have with your family and how it's been shaped by ultra running. One of the stories, it's quite a long way into the book, but I just wanted to touch on it that while we're opening the podcast, is that you sit down during your Western States race and you sit down next to a guy called Simon from London. And that's why I thought as a UK podcast, this would be quite a funny story. And he's chittering on to you going, oh, I met you in a run in Hyde Park. And you're going, you're being very polite as you are being now, going, yes, 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 yeah. I remember. And you being like, I have no recollection of this guy at all. And then do you remember what you've written in his book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was chilling when he said that.
It gave me goosebumps when I read it. I was like, that is incredible.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I was exhausted. We were at mile 85 of a 100-mile race, and it's the middle of the night, and I sit down next to this guy, and he's like, oh, yeah, I know you. And I'm like, oh cool. Yeah, great. He's like, I met you in Hyde Park 5 years ago. I'm like, okay, cool. And he's like, my name's Simon. I'm like, all right, nice to meet you, Simon. You know, I'm trying to undo my shoe or something or get a sticker out of my sock. And he said, you signed my book. And I said, oh, cool. He's like, you know, you wrote. And I said, no, Simon, what did I write? And he said, you wrote, I'll see you at Western States. And I'd written that 5 years ago, and just I randomly ended up on this seat at mile 85 during this race that he somehow got into, and we sat down next to each other, and it was just, it just came full circle. Like, I signed so many people's books, and they say to me, my dream is to like one day run Badwater, one day run Western States.
Yeah.
And so I just write good luck there. And I never think that much about it, but that it just struck me that how profound it was that I was sitting right next to Simon during this race. Yeah, it was one of those moments that you know, you'll never forget.
Do you think Simon knows he's in your book?
I hope he does. He's a rosy faced Brit, and it was
find him.
He might be a listener. Like, let's reach out to our listeners. Let's find Simon.
I can be on my next book is Finding Simon. That's
yeah.
The ultra marathon man, Finding Simon.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm really interested. A typical day for Dean Karnassus. I know, you know, you travel around the world, so quite often your days aren't similar, but yeah, you're back home. What would a day look like for you?
You know, when I have a training block that I'm really focusing on a particular race coming up, I like to get up early in the morning, real early, like, you know, 3:30 in the morning. And I like to run a marathon just right out of bed. So running not a fast marathon, maybe a, you know, a 4 to 4:15 marathon,
yeah.
But in like with some elevation gain, you know, with a few thousand feet, at least a few thousand feet of elevation. And then I never sit down throughout the course of the day. So you can probably see even right now. So
yeah, standing there.
The moment I get out of bed until the moment I crawl back into bed, I don't sit down. I mean, obviously, if I need to drive somewhere or I'm on a plane, I have to sit down. But if not, I don't sit down. So I do all my writing, all my interviews, everything standing up. And I also have this, what's called the HIIT routine, high intensity interval training.
Yeah.
Mostly with body weight. And I do sets throughout the course of the day, 5 or 6 sets. And it's about a 12 to 14 minute routine of push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, chair dips, and these things called burpees.
Oh yeah, the burpees.
Burpees, which everyone hates. I say burpees and I'm like, oh God, burpees.
Yeah.
But I do this, this body weight routine throughout the course of the day. And then, you know, I like to double up. So I like to go for a shorter, faster run, like a tempo run in the evening, you know, maybe 7 or 8 miles.
So if you're getting up so early, what time are you trying to get 8 hours sleep still? Would you go to bed super early?
You know, on those nights, I'm probably getting 6 hours.
Okay.
Maybe 7, but I don't do it every night, but I don't feel it anymore. Like I don't feel sleep deprivation the way I used to. To me now it's easy to go through 2 nights without sleep where you know, I could get through 1 night without sleep, but that second night was always kind of a struggle now.
And I was going to ask later on actually, if you're a coached or self-coached athlete, but I don't know many coaches that would say do a marathon every day. So I'm assuming you're a self-coached athlete.
Yeah. I mean, I always say, listen to everyone, follow no one. So I've had many different coaches throughout the years.
Yeah.
There's one guy that I really respect. His name is Jason Koop.
Oh yeah.
And he's kind of been like a voice of reason, but you know, he kind of said, you're an N of one, like geez, over a quarter century of doing these ultra marathons, I've never had an injury. And he's like this, you know, it's usually people that are taking on your volume have overtraining injuries. I mean, that's incredible. And you just don't seem to suffer those things.
I'm really curious also with your family, do they share your love of running?
My wife runs if she's being chased by a wild animal.
Okay.
She's not a runner. And my kids, they both love to run, but just casually. They don't race. You know, we've done a couple races together before. But they're, you know, they just have a passion for running. And, you know, as a father, they've only known me as kind of the ultra marathon man because, you know, I was doing this their whole lives. So I don't think they necessarily see me as different than any other father. You know, I don't think they view my running as anything extraordinary or unusual.
Yeah, you're just dad.
And I don't push it on him because I was always afraid of the parental backlash.
Your family played a big part in crewing through the book. Any tips for friends or family offering to crew, say, an ultra runner?
Yeah, I mean, my advice is crew with your ears.
Yeah.
And that means literally listen to your runner when they come into an aid station. I think the natural tendency of a crew member is just to offer things up.
Yeah.
And they see a runner that's hurting, you know, do you want this? Do you need this? Do you want this? Can I get you this? And you guys know when you're just in that exhaustive state, it's overwhelming to have all these questions. You don't want stimuli, you're overstimulated already. And you pretty much have been thinking probably for the last, 45 minutes or an hour, exactly what you need when you get to that aid station. Like, oh, geez, I need to change my socks.
Yeah.
You know, I need some electrolytes. I need, a couple of gel packs. The light in my headlamp needs refreshing or recharging.
Yeah.
So you can kind of just tell the crew what you need. But most crew members, when they see you, they just start volunteering things. And I think that's counterproductive in a lot of cases.
Yeah, being a moment of calm and just like, my husband crews really well for me and he just watches me come in and he says that gives him a lot of feedback is how I approach the aid station. Like if I'm approaching it like with purpose and I'm running, he's like, we're on. But if he sees me coming looking like a wounded animal, he's like, okay, we need a different strategy.
Maybe a bit of a psychologist, I think, sometimes. You do need to read people and, just see how to manage them.
In your book, Dean, quite a few of your races don't go to plan. You describe ultramarathons as journeys filled with lots of little moments that, when strung together, form the story of your race, which I just loved. It was just rang so true to me. How do you handle the moments in races when everything is going south and the finish line seems an impossibility?
Yeah, I mean, when I, the races that I describe in the book, I think are races that are better stories than a good race. Like a good race is not quite as dramatic to me. So that's why I kind of chose those stories to write about. You know, I always say that running an ultramarathon builds character, but it also reveals character. And I think, you run an ultramarathon with someone and you see that true person. Me, I become like a happy drunk when I get really exhausted. I just kind of I'm giddy and fun loving and, to a point. And when things really, really get tough, I tend not to think at all. I think thinking is a problem. I think we start to overthink, overanalyze things. And instead I just try to execute and just be the best that I can be in that moment in time,
The
here and now. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really important, I think, to be present in the here and now. You kind of overanalyze things. Early on in the book, you mentioned you needed to take an ice bath. And I thought that was quite, I hear friends sometimes say they need to go for a 20-mile run. And I think to myself, well, you don't necessarily need to do that. But I also thought it was great self-discipline. I struggle personally with self-discipline, make the wrong choices maybe from a recovery point of view and nutritionally. But yeah, does self-discipline, does that come pretty easy to you?
Yeah, I don't know why. I've never, even when it comes to diet and food choices, I'm pretty regimented and pretty strict. And I don't have cheat days in my diet. I don't really struggle so much with self-discipline. I'm pretty self-motivated as well. You know, it's funny. My mom used to think I was going to be a priest because she used to take me to church. And if, we were Greek Orthodox, I'm 100% Greek. And if you've ever been to like divine liturgy at a Greek Orthodox church, it is an endurance event like nothing else. I mean, it's like 4 hours of listening to someone in Greek. Basically repeating the same lines 5 or 6 times.
Yeah.
And, at 5 years old, all I was trying to do was like force myself to be disciplined and not fidget. And I remember this clearly. I remember like looking to my left and to my right and people were collapsing in the pews. Just I was so steadfast. Like, I'm not going to fall asleep. I'm just going to stand here and, sit here and listen for 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know, maybe it's just a discipline thing, but I've always been kind of self-disciplined.
That is an endurance event. Yeah, I've really since we've been kind of trying to schedule a date, I've paid a lot more attention to your social media. Do you go to Greece and spend that amount of time every year? It's been a great follow.
Yeah, this last year or this year, 2021, I spent a little more time than usual, just because I think the pandemic has kind of put a sense of urgency into all of us, including myself. And, you know, I've been on all seven continents twice, but I still feel like I have this wanderlust that is almost insatiable. Yeah. So I spent close to 2 months in Greece. And, you know, it's, again, I'm 100% Greek, and Greek is really the birthplace of long distance running and the Olympics. And just to go to these places, I don't know if you guys have ever been to Greece, but, you know, to go to these places that Homer writes about, you know, 3,000 years ago, and see that they haven't changed. It's unlike any place on earth. You know, you go to ancient Olympia, the original Olympic Stadium, you know, where the Olympics were born, and it's like a field. Yeah. It's like a little handmade sign that says, "Hey, this is, you know, this is where the Olympics were born." It's, you know, most places in the States, it would be cordoned off, and there'd be, you know, park rangers and, you know, signs and, you know, a toll booth and everything else. And in Greece, it's just like out in a field. Wow, that's where the Olympics took place. Yeah.
I was brought up in Northern Cyprus quite a bit. And we used to go around all the most amazing, like, mosaics in the Greek churches, and you could just free roam. And we must have been like 8 or 9, and over all these old ruins, no safety ropes, nothing, and no protection of any of these. I wonder if it's got a bit better now, but we used to just like walk over all these really like thousands and thousands of year old mosaics. And like you said, just in the field, Dad would just park the car and be like, "Well, we walk in 2 hours and we're going to find this old church." But it was amazing. And I always think the Greek people are incredibly welcoming. And the food.
Yeah. The food. Yeah, you know, the food. It was, you know, I just thought I'm going to spend some extended time in Greece and, you know, see. Greece is such a diverse country. I mean, there's, you know, there's 2,000 islands. Most people go to two islands, Santorini and Mykonos, but there's so many islands to explore. You know, on mainland Greece, there are mountains, like pine-covered mountains, you know, with snow, and there are, you know, and everything in between. There's arid areas. The Cyclades Islands are almost like desert islands. So it's I don't know why, but it's very conducive to running. You just feel like you want to run when you get to Greece.
Because I think your core temperature is warmed because the climate is so wonderful.
Oh, I went out for a midday run once in Cyprus, and it wasn't a good idea for this this fair skinned Brit. Didn't last long. It wasn't quite your initial run when you were 30 year old and out of the bar. I probably had the same kind of attire on, but yeah, and didn't go so well.
I've got another question for you, Dean, while my internet is decided to work again. A big question, a deep question. The big question of why we do this ultra running to ourselves. Last weekend, I ran a 100 miler, and I then on Monday morning have to take the kids to school, and I'm hobbling to get them up to the school gates. And mums and dads are like, Eddie, why would you do this? Why do you do this? Have you got a good reply for me? Because I can't, you explain it so well, and I cannot explain really why I put myself through this, what it is inside of me that drives me to do this and to enjoy it as well. Have you got a good reply I could say to the mums and dads at school gates?
I don't know if they'd get it, but I mean.
No, but that's the thing. That's what I say to my husband too, is like, I can't reply because I don't think they get it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a quote that I had from my first book, there's magic in misery. And most people don't get that, but a runner gets that. Like, you know, like at those points where you're just, everything is just painful and impossible, that you never feel more alive. And I don't know if you want to say this to them, but, you know, running 100 miles, it transcends the ordinary, right? You know, for a moment, you're released from being just an average citizen. You're like something extraordinary, doing something that most people could never, ever dream of doing. You know, although they're asking you why, I'm imagining in private conversations, there's a hell of a lot of admiration for what you're doing. whether they understand it or not, just because everyone has run at some point in their life. Running is very identifiable. Some people have just been punished by having to run around the schoolyard if they did something wrong, yeah. and they know how difficult it was. You know, I remember saying to a taxi driver one time that someone just broke a 2-hour marathon. And the taxi driver said to me, "Wow, that's amazing. How far is a marathon?"
Yeah, yeah.
So he didn't know. But when you say to someone, "I ran 100 miles, like, what? Hold it. Like, I can't even drive 100 miles. Like, it's, they get it. And they realize the enormity of what you did.
Sometimes so we'll do an event, like Eddie mentioned, 100 miles. And then something will happen in my life where I can actually quantify what 100 miles is. And even though I've done it myself, it puzzles me how you can do it. But I do love the fact that A, lucky enough to be fit enough, and B, have the confidence to toe the line.
Confidence and the bravery. Let's face it, you have to be brave to toe the line of a 100 miler. I mean, it's an undertaking that is going to try to destroy you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to persevere requires courage. So anyone who runs 100 miles to me I have such respect for them. Yeah. And I don't care if you're, you know, the winning 100 miles or if you're, you know, just getting in before the final cutoff. I have the same amount of respect for anyone who's doing that because there's just nothing easy about it.
Why the Western States? As a Brit, it definitely casts a bit of a spell on me as an event. But, with the lottery and everything and the distance, it's something that I think maybe I never would do. But yeah, why the Western States? Why is it so special for you?
You know, I think it's because it was the first 100 miler. For those of you that don't know the Western States, it's a 100 mile foot race here in California where I live through the Sierra Nevada mountain range.
Yeah.
And it started as, you know, the lore is it started as a horse race. One year, a guy who'd been training, a really fit guy, had been training all year with his horse. A couple of days before the race, his horse went lame. So he said, "I'm still going to do the race." And they said, "Well, how? You don't have a horse." And he said, "Well, I'm just going to run." You know, and somehow they let him try it. And somehow he finished. And when he got to the finish, they didn't have traditional medals. Like when you run a marathon, you know, you get a medal over your neck.
Yeah.
Because it was a horse race, not a running race. And what they gave the horse racers were these rodeo buckles. So they had a rodeo buckle. So they just said, "Let's give him one of those." You didn't have a horse, but it's the same prize. And that's kind of like where the whole, the tradition of getting a belt buckle for finishing a 100 mile race comes from.
Yeah.
So there's that lore. And the other thing is that because it's restricted to 369 entrants,
yeah,
because of a strange set of circumstances, but it can never be more than that. So, you know, the supply is limited, which kind of gives it this kind of exclusivity, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think that has some of the appeal. But to your point, you know, the odds of getting into Western States with the lottery system are lower than the odds of getting into Harvard.
Oh, my goodness. Oh yeah, because I was trying to explain to Gary, I was like, I don't know what the odds are, but they're really, really low.
Yeah,
and that's the odds, is it?
Yeah, and your odds get better if you submit like year after year. Yeah.
Okay.
But that means you still have to qualify. I mean, you're still chasing something that you're never quite sure you'll ever get into. You know, if you have a bad race at Western States, it's really bad.
Yeah.
Because you spent like 5 or 6 years trying to get into this darn thing, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you get in, you're going to bring your family because this is the one time you get to run Western States. And, you know, if you're from overseas, you're going to fly everyone over and you're going to rent cars and everything else. So it's very expensive.
Yeah.
And if you're having a bad race, it's just not a good scene.
Have you noticed the change in the race as it's become? I can't really say it's become more commercialized, but I guess it's just more popular and ultra running has exploded. Have you noticed what sort of changes in the race have you noticed?
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed that there are more spectators. And I think not a lot of spectators come out. Well, I think the reason for the growth of the spectators is that dynamic I explained is that if you get like when I used to get into Western States before, it was not that hard to get into because if you finish in the top 10, you get an automatic entry. So I was always finishing in the top 10 and getting an automatic entry. So, you know, my family would come along, but it wasn't that big a deal. Now, if you get into Western States, you're going to bring, you know, Aunt Faye, you're going to bring Uncle Bob.
Grandma Joan.
Yeah, you got to bring your kids, your neighbor's kids. Like everyone's got to see you across this finish line. So people are traveling with harems, you know, big groups and even running clubs. Like if one of the person in the running club gets in, like the whole running club is going to come out and support this individual. So That's changed a bit. Yeah.
I don't think I could wing a kind of boys' weekend away or a week in the States. It would have to be wife and two children would come with me too.
Sorry. Do you think a big part of your book is your journey of running that Western States? Do you think you'll ever run it again now, Dean? Or do you think that's the end of it's the end of your journey over there on Squaw Valley?
Yeah, no, I want to run it on an occasion, maybe like when I turn 60 or 70, something like that. I mean, you know, I don't want to be selfish, and I have, you know, I'd love to chase the record for the most finishes ever at Western States.
Yeah.
But the reality is that number 369 is a set number. So if I'm in the race, then another person that's maybe been trying for 6 or 7 years is not in the race. And, you know, I have 13 buckles. I mean, you know, I've got my war chest of awards. It's like, you know, it's almost selfish, I think, to do much more than that. But if there's an occasion, like I said, my 60th or 70th birthday, I definitely want to run it again. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever done Hard Rock? Have you ever raced Hard Rock?
No, that's one. I mean, there's so many races I still want to do. I haven't done Hard Rock. I haven't done Barkley.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many races that I could do besides Western States.
I look at the stats for Hard Rock, and is it 33,000 feet or something? Which again, for a Brit, is just, that's like mind-bending kind of numbers for a 100-mile distance. I think we have the Lakeland 100, which could be 19,000 feet. So yeah, 33,000 feet. There wouldn't be much running going on there, surely, for that race.
You got to, you know, if you're good with poles, you're good at Hard Rock. I mean, if you can use poles well. You know, to me, the climbing, the overall climbing appeals to me. The thing that doesn't appeal to me is that it's at such a high altitude.
Yeah.
Because I mean, even though I live in around areas with lots of climbing, it's at sea level.
Yeah.
But you know, you get up in the mountains. Like I've done Leadville a few times, and even, you know, Leadville's not quite as high in the sky. Well, Leadville, I think, is higher in the sky at the start, but it's not as much altitude gain overall. But it's still tough, just because it's, you know, you go over Hope Pass, which is 12,500 feet above sea level.
Yeah. I've got a long question here, Dean, so bear with me. It's a long question, but it might be answered quite quickly. Right. In the book, you talk about, is it the 526-kilometer Silk Road? It's more of like a diplomatic run that you did. And there was a wonderful food and drink anecdote. Kumis, is that the drink that you had?
Kumis, yep.
Yeah. No, kind of familiar with this, and I probably would have had a few cups of that. So I set the scene. We're at the end of a race. There's no buffet of treats to recover on. You reach into your backpack and you've got some pickled gherkins and some kumis, and I'll trade with you whatever's in my backpack. What would you hope for as a swap out? You weren't a fan of pickled gherkins either from memory, and the drink definitely didn't go down well.
No, but I mean, the drink, just to set the stage, I mean, I just run, I think, 40 miles across Uzbekistan, you know, in the desert in July, in the middle of summer. And I came running into this township, and I was a U.S. diplomat. I was an athlete ambassador.
Yeah.
So the entire town was out. Like, there's 3,000 people waiting to accept me coming into their town. And there were these women in traditional dress. It was a really beautiful ceremony, but one of the women held out this, it looked like a half of a coconut shell, like, you know, held out this like coconut shell filled with this white liquid to me.
Yeah.
And I was to drink this. That's how I was briefed by the State Department. So I thought, oh, it's going to be something cool and refreshing, like a pina colada or something.
Yeah.
And, I hoped.
Yeah. It was kumis, which kumis is warm fermented mare's milk.
Yep.
So horse milk. And it tasted, the best description would be if you were to mix sour cream into a glass of champagne and put it in the microwave and then drink it. That was kind of what it tasted like.
Gary, do you really want to drink this?
Well, the story is when my wife is half Finnish, and in Finland they have a drink called Pima, which is a cold version of that. And now in England, we can get kefir, which is similar to Pima, which is So yeah, I think I could stomach a half a liter of that. It'd be quite good.
Gary, I don't know. I like kefir. I do like kefir.
Okay.
Kumis is a whole nother level.
All right, maybe I've set myself up for something.
Dean, you haven't yet said what you'd have. What's your choice of snack post the minute you finish a long race or run?
You know, I used to love pizza, but those days are over. So now what I really love, ironically, is savory food. So like salmon. I just go crazy over salmon. Like there's a race called the Big Sur International Marathon, which you guys probably, you might know of Big Sur. So
yeah,
I do an out and back. So I do basically two marathons back to back.
That's right.
And it finishes in Monterey, California, which is a big seafood place. It's right on the coast. And they have these platters of smoked salmon.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
I just go right to that area of the buffet line.
I'll let you go there, Dean. I don't think I could cope with the salmon.
Not a salmon fan.
A lot of your book is all about sort of learning as we get older, as you're moving through the years, your learnings from ultra, from your life, from your dealings with your family, from races. And a big thing comes up in the book, and a big learning I think a lot of people have from that ultra running teaches us in life is failure. And you talk and you say failure sucks. And that's one of your biggest drives to the finish line, is that you know how bad you feel when you don't finish something. Is that, do you think, one of your biggest learnings you've sort of taken as you've got older through this sport? That I think when we're younger, we don't really care and we're not afraid of failure. But I think personally, as I've grown older, it's a bigger monkey on my shoulder.
Yeah, I think maybe as we get older, we're still trying to prove ourselves. But, you know, I think that, you know, when you distill down the lessons you learn from, I mean, people are always saying, well, tell me about the lessons you learned from failure. Yeah, there are practical lessons, but I think the biggest takeaway is that it really sucks.
You have to live with it, don't you?
I hate failing. I hate it. Yeah. Who doesn't hate failing? It's horrible. Yeah. And, you know, you guys are as resilient as I am. I mean, the only thing that I think about when I fail is, damn it, I'm coming back to succeed. Yeah.
I often say that I'm a running coach, and I say that especially if clients are going out 100 miles, it seems to be like, I'm like, just think about how you feel the next day. You know, if you're at the office or you're in your house, like, you got to live. If you DNF for any, you know, injury, you know, so things do go wrong. But if it's for you just didn't finish, you living with that is much harder than the next few hours of grizzling out a finish. But sometimes we have to go through failure to realize that, don't we?
You know, the pain goes away, but the failure doesn't go away.
Yeah,
it sticks with you. Yeah.
I'm 48 now, Dean, and I'm
no way, Gary. You don't look it.
You wouldn't know, would you? No. It's a Vaseline on the lens. I'm always looking at ways to, and I felt it. You know, to be honest, I think probably the last couple of years, I probably felt it takes a little bit longer to recover. Is there anything that you could, you know, say in particular that maybe, yeah, once I did that, I really noticed, you know, I kind of had a bit more of a spring in my step afterwards, or became more resilient?
You know, I'm a big fan of active recovery. So I always say the next day after a big effort to go out and run, I mean, hobble, I don't even say run, just shuffle. For, I don't know, 3 or 4 kilometers, if you can, just to get your heart rate elevated. I think active recovery really helps with overall recovery.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that I always do is I overhydrate. So I really flush out my system. I drink enough liquid that my pee is clear.
Okay.
So I think that helps. You know, if you're traveling, we've talked a bit about traveling. I mean, compression, when you get on that plane after a marathon or an ultra, to me is critical.
Yeah.
So compression tights, compression socks, you know, quality of sleep. And when I say quality of sleep, typically that means the temperature of the room you're sleeping in.
Yeah.
And to get it really cool, because, you know, your metabolism's so revved up after a big effort that your core body temperature is elevated.
Yeah.
So keeping cool at night is really important. So I think that, you know, keeping the room cool will help get a better night's sleep.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know you guys, you might or may not be a fan of cold water fish, salmon being one, but
yeah.
mackerel, sardines, anchovies, cold water fish.
Yeah.
To me are the best recovery foods. It's a high quality protein and the omega-3 fatty acids in there.
Yeah. Oh, I do like the smoked salmon. Yeah,
get that brain fog. Because I was saying to Gary, like the brain fog post-ultra is a real deal. It's a real illness when you're like, you've dug so deep into yourself and then the next week or so actually forming a sentence or remembering the kids' names.
Yeah.
I need that tip, Dean. I will hit the oily fish. You're really active on social media. Gary and I have both been following you and enjoyed your journey in Greece. And you strike a really good balance between your sort of your life, but also your athletic endeavors and your work with your sponsors. How is that relationship with social media for you? Are you able to sort of switch off? Because obviously when your journey started, I mean, there wasn't probably even Facebook, was there? It's sort of evolved. Do you find that you can't switch off from social media, or is it something that you're quite controlled and it is work for you and you're able to sort of step away from it?
Yeah, I think I have a pretty healthy relationship overall with social media. I see it as necessary, but I'm not a prisoner to it. So, what you're seeing on social media is some of my life, but it's, there's certainly a lot of things I don't post on social media. But, I think that to me, my social media presence is very positive. I don't like frequent these really harsh, negative locations. I don't even know where they are to find them. But to me, runners are just very positive people overall. And I think that I just attract kindred spirits. So it's kind of like a place of positivity. I try to inspire a bit. I hate that word inspire, but I try to post stuff that is energizing. So when you look at it, you don't feel threatened by it. You don't feel intimidated or put off by it. You just feel like, oh man, that's gorgeous. I want to go running now. Like that is just, that inspires me to get out the door. So hopefully, some of the content I'm posting is motivating and energizing people.
I thought it was great fun. And unwittingly or not, I just thought you struck a great balance. I really enjoyed following you the past few months.
Last question before we kick into our bonus questions, Dean. Quite a few of your anecdotes in your books are run-ins with volunteers at aid stations and how their wisdom, but also their kindness kicks your butt back out on the trail. And often they say a little nugget that you carry with you for the next section of the race. Is there one of these experiences that sort of stands out most, either from the book or from your trail running career? Someone said something to you at an aid station that sort of stayed with you.
I've had so many people say things to me that are so profound in the moment, as far as like not getting to the finish line, when you're halfway through it and you're just destroyed, and someone saying, you just get to the tree up the trail, or just get to the corner in the trail. Don't think about the finish line. So I think that, that brings you back to the present, the here and now. I think that, that's always been something that stuck with me. But I've learned some practical advice about DNFing, and most DNFs take place at aid stations.
Yeah.
And most often what happens, and I've certainly been there, is when you're struggling, you start thinking, I'm done. I'm going to drop out when I get to the next aid station. And that formulates in your mind for maybe an hour, 45 minutes, whatever it takes. You get to the aid station, you just announce, I'm done. Let's go. You turn in your race bib, you get in your crew car, you start driving away. And 15 minutes later, you kind of come back to life. And you're like, why did I drop out? Like, I'm kind of feeling better now. So I always tell people, never drop out at an aid station. Just, regroup. An ultra doesn't happen quickly. Have something to eat. Sit down for a second. Have something to drink. Just, regroup a little bit. And don't DNF at an aid station. And then get up when you're kind of regrouped, get up and just walk. Walk out of the aid station. Just walk. Don't even look at your watch. Just walk. And inevitably, you get a mile or two down the trail and all of a sudden you like start coming back to life. And if not, you think, geez, I'm already a mile or two into, I'm not gonna turn around and go back. Yeah. There's only one direction to go. So I guess my advice, and I'm kind of twisting your question around, but I think my advice
is... No, it's brilliant. No, it's much better than my... It's a much better answer than my question.
I just learned do not DNF at an aid station.
I think that's brilliant. And that a little nugget like that, people might just remember when they're out running and the Dean will be like, what does Dean do? We need bracelets like with what does Dean do?
But you're right, though. You do pick up. You know, you leave the aid station, the food kicks in or whatever, the bit of rest you've had. And before you know it, you know, your mood improves. Great advice.
Both your books have given me, Dean, is like the embracing of the suffering, knowing that it's normal. Like, you're so honest about how hard an ultra is and how deep you have to go. And in your book, you're at some really terribly low points and it's all going horribly wrong. And you pull yourself through it. And I'm like, well, that if that happens to Dean and he can do that, we can all do that. And I think that's really that has really helped me in my ultra journey as well, knowing that, like, as low as you go, you're not really that low. You can, you know, there's a quote going around on Instagram, isn't there, at the moment, like, if you think you're 45%, if you think you're done, you're only 45% cooked, or something like that. I think that's...
Well, I mean, the one I love is embrace the suck.
Embrace the suck, yeah.
Yeah, really, really learn to, like, cherish those horrible moments, you know, to really experience the full range of human emotions. Yeah, the highs are great, but also celebrate the lows when just it's horrible, and just kind of take it all in and be present and absorb it. I mean, the best lesson I can, the best example I can give is I did the 100-mile or the 24-hour world championships one time. And there's a guy on the Team USA, his name was Roy, a really tough guy, an Ironman, a multiple time Ironman. And this guy was just tough. He was like a plumber and a smoker and a drinker. And he just cleaned up his life and became an ultra marathoner. And I ran by him at like 20 hours in and he was destroyed. I mean, he was covered in, you know, salt, like, you know, that caked white salt, dehydrated. He was shivering on a cot. And I looked down, there was a medic that was lancing a blood blister on his toe that was like the size of a marble. And as I ran by, he looked up at me and he just mouthed, "I love this shit." I mean, he looked like he was going to die. And this guy is lancing a blood blister on his toe. He's like, "I love this shit."
That sounds like something you would say, Eddie.
Yeah, it is. I do. It's terrible.
That's an awesome story. Should we do our quick five?
Quick five, all right. Dean.
Okie doke, Dean.
I didn't do anything quick, so okay. We'll see how this goes. Yeah.
Older, wiser, stronger, slower. Race still on your to-do list?
Ooh, I got a big goal set for 2023.
Okay.
And I've learned that it's just for a sense of dignity, it's better not to describe what it is.
Okay.
And get on this podcast in 2024 and talk about what it was all about.
Read the book.
But it's going to be something unprecedented. It's going to take 6 months of hard effort and hopefully I'll be alive to come back on the podcast.
Oh, wow. Epic. Fantastic. Oh, I look forward to that. Right. Mobile technology. Would you switch it off during the night or would you be left on your bedside table?
Hell no. Switched off. You know, what's the first thing you read on Instagram in the morning? I'm like, I don't read Instagram in the morning. So I've, you know, like,
yeah,
no, I'm not. That thing is, it's with me very little time. That's good. Yeah, and that screen.
Do you have a running mantra?
No, not really. No.
Embrace the suck.
Embrace the suck. Yeah. I mean, I think about that theme quite a bit. Yeah. You know, I think about the theme that, you know, you've been here before, which is kind of the same thing. Like, you've been at this low point before and you've gotten through it. So you kind of, you know, through experience that you can do it again.
A go-to pair of shoes, you know, your kind of daily commute shoes or daily run shoes.
You know, I work with this new brand called Speedland, and they're a trail-only shoe. So this is only for the trail. This is not for the road.
Yeah.
And these guys are ex-Nike footwear designers, and they just got tired with the financial constraints, you know, of building footwear. So they just said, screw it. We're just going to build the best pair of running trail shoes there is. We don't even care what it costs. And they did it. I mean, the shoes are $375 US.
Okay. Well, yeah.
So they're not cheap, but they're made. They're, once you wear them, it's unlike any other shoe I've ever put on. But, you know, the downside is they're really, really expensive. And they're only for the trails.
What makes them so so amazing?
Primarily the materials they use. So they use really aerospace materials. They have no laces. So it's this BOA lacing system, a dual lacing system that they've really fine-tuned. So I don't know about you guys, but I hate playing around with shoelaces, especially.
Oh, my God. And how bad is it if the lace comes undone? Yeah. And my hamstrings are tight the best of times, but there's no way I'm doing that lace up.
We have a lot of chat on this podcast about a fell running challenge in the UK called the Bob Graham Round. Have you heard of the Bob Graham Round?
Of course.
Hey.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, the next question is, have you considered giving it a go?
I don't do well in the cold. I know you guys are going to laugh at me. I'd rather do something in Greece.
Well, I did mine. Mine was June. It doesn't have to be in the winter. You can pick and choose your dates. I think not many people, to be honest, do it in the winter. There's probably a handful, but through the summer months, at least, it's quite busy on the fells.
Imagine if Dean going to do it. The gaggle of people.
Yeah,
I'd more prefer to do that. I mean, I'm beyond the dream of ever setting a, you know, breaking the KT on that one.
Yeah.
But doing it as a group, you know, with a bunch of people or people joining along the way as a charity or something like that, I would love to do.
I think I can still remember the route, most of it. and you mentioned that you do kind of technically need a group because you need people to witness that you've actually been to the summit. So it would never be a solo effort, at least for the first time. That's it. Top five. Brilliant. I know you recently, there was the Golden Gate Trail Classic. We just missed that, obviously. But if any of our listeners fancies a trip to San Francisco, what could they get from? There's quite a few different events, isn't there? It's not just one race.
Yes. This year we had four events. So we had a 100 kilometer, 50 kilometer, 21 kilometer, so a half marathon and a 10K. And they're all on trails in a place called the Marin Headlands, which is just across the Golden Gate Bridge. So it's really spectacular running, very scenic. And you have San Francisco as the backdrop. And you start and finish by running across the Golden Gate Bridge. So many ultras are kind of out in the middle of nowhere, right? And there's, you know, you don't see a lot of people. And, you know, it might be at a little town where you finish. But in San Francisco, you know, you have the urban setting and there's a lot of celebration at the start and, you know, you're in a city and then you're out in the mountains by yourself, you know, and then 10 hours later, you come back into the city with all that energy and, you know, band playing and so forth. So that was kind of the vibe I wanted to bring to this race. And also very liberal cutoff times.
Yeah.
So we had a 25 hour cutoff for the 100K. I wanted to be approachable and user friendly. So people didn't feel intimidated. Yeah. And a lot of people, you know, when things get really bad, we probably don't face this problem too often, but I hear it a lot. When things are really bad during a race and you're kind of a back of the pack runner anyway, you know, having this looming cutoff just exacerbates things and it makes it kind of unpleasant. So with the 25 hour cutoff, most people that could get to the finish line got to the finish line.
We just talked about this the other week, didn't we? About making it more inclusive, some races. And some people might be intimidated by a race building itself as being the toughest, the longest, the hardest. So, I really like that approach. Anything to
We were saying we wish races build themselves as accessible and friendly. And, you know, it didn't have to be these big dramatic verbs. It could be more welcoming and inclusive. Yeah. But, you know, it sells races.
San Francisco is known as a city of love.
So there we go.
That's, yeah.
It's a wonderful place.
Yeah. Oh, Dean, thank you so much. It means the world to us coming on our podcast. Your books have inspired Gary, me, and probably every single person listening and every single person probably that's trodden an ultra, though you're far too humble to realize, I'm sure, what you've done for this community. But many thanks. And if you haven't read Dean's book yet, grab it. I've done hundreds of vultures, but I learned so much from your second book as well. So thank you so much. Keep up the good work. And we look forward to your huge adventure.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want a bit of company, me and Gary, we probably can find you somewhere.
Yeah, we'll have a chat with the sponsor.
You got to sign a release, a pretty long release to be able to go on okay. this one.
That's fine. We can read. That's fine. We can do that. We're not that busy.
I don't like paperwork, Eddie.
Good luck with all your future endeavors, Dean, from everybody at Run to the Hills. And hope to speak to you again in a couple of years.
Thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed it. Yeah.
Take care.
Thanks. You well.
Thanks so much, Dean, for giving up your time and coming on the show. If you, I think that audiobook of that book is out now.
It is,
yeah. But it's a super read, or a super listen. I'd read his first book, Ultramarathon Man, first if you haven't read it yet, because it kind of follows on the second part of his journey. I had quite a few internet problems during that interview. It doesn't happen very much that we have proper internet worries.
Man
anyway,
down.
It was a serious man down. I kept logging. Oh my gosh, it was so embarrassing. But Gary has done a remarkable job with the editing and the sweat. I mean,
I relived it.
We recorded it quite late. I don't think I went to sleep for like 4 hours afterwards because the cortisol come down was huge. But if you do read the book, let us know what you think about it and give a shout out to Dean because it was really kind of him to give up his time for that interview. Over Christmas, I posted on our Run to the Hills Facebook page about a crowdfunder group that had been set up in memory of John Kynaston. But we've been thinking about ways that we could remember John, and lots of ideas have been floating around. But this is one idea which I think is incredible. The West Highland Way race directors would like to remember John by funding a replacement of a bridge on the West Highland Way Trail. The bridge will be a replacement for the original bridge, which was washed away in a severe storm. It's about 2 miles north of Ben Glass Farm near Derry Darroch. And they are aiming to raise about £15,000. And so far, they've raised just over £6,000. So if you would like to donate a little bit of money in John's memory, perhaps you knew John, perhaps you've watched some of his videos of the Lakeland 50 and 100 or many of his other videos, pop over onto that page. The link is on our Facebook page and just give a little bit of donation. And I think, lots of lovely comments on there and lots of people saying, what a way to remember him. He would be proud as punch that he was going to be on that West Highland Way, on that bridge. And all those runners will be crossing over and he will be part of everybody's journey. He would be absolutely thrilled with that. So pop over. I pinned the post on the top of our Facebook page. So pop over there if you would like to give a little donation. Races coming up. You found one. We've got lots of races happening in the second week of January, but quiet, everybody just getting over their hangovers a little bit, maybe this weekend.
Sometimes a bit of a shock to the system, isn't it? If you've got a race January, it's like, oh my God.
I've done country to capital when I was down south in England a few times, which is a big, probably the only ultra round down south of England. And that's January, the first weekend, second weekend in January, maybe it is. So it's just further enough away from Christmas because I think if you do the spine, you must have that hanging over you. I mean, you're doing the taper over Christmas, which must be nice.
That will keep you honest, wouldn't it? Over Christmas, I got about 40 Stroop waffles to make my way through, and I was doing the spine, then wait till February.
I mean, how much? I'm not sure I'd enjoy Christmas if I knew what was coming, but in other ways, you would, because you'd be like, I'm going to really enjoy this warm family time, because in a week's time, I'm going to be out in the middle of nowhere. But I don't know if I could get myself into that mind switch. Because I've softened so much, Gary, for Christmas. So I'm not tough. I need to get myself back.
Hey, I don't know about in France though, and it might not hang around for the spine, but we have got a nice warm southwesterly coming to England, which if that hangs around stuff, they're talking about 15 degrees.
Yeah, we've got warm weather coming tomorrow, 12 degrees.
Yeah.
What the blazes?
So if that's there for the spine.
How am I going to wear my new leggings in 12 degrees, Gary?
Just up higher. It's cooler.
Imagine if that's there for the spine. Will it mean everything gets really wet, though? Because if stuff is frozen as well.
It is still pretty wet. There's a big bank of rain at the moment here. But I can cope with the wind and the rain. The wind and the rain, if you chuck cold in there as well, that's me, game over.
You're going down. Gary's going down. No amount of fruit waffles is going to get that back. But you've found a race. You've got a race coming up near you.
Indeed. Now, I've raced the Old Monks, raced it. I've run it a few times, maybe half a dozen times. Maybe not that many times, but it's local to me. So I've done that route tons and tons of times. It's a great route, a bit of tarmac, some good trail and some old railway line cycle paths. So some sections to open your legs. And there's a really lovely, maybe about a mile with a good downhill at the end. So if you've got something left in your legs, it's a real good finish. And I think, although it's happening on the 2nd, and we're recording this on the Wednesday, the 28th, but currently currently there's still entries open. So if you fancy a little spinning the legs over, I think it's about 5.5-6 miles. So great, you know, nothing too arduous. And it is, yeah, just real nice trails, nothing too epic. Just a good race. I think it's about 14 quid if you're non-UK athletics affiliated. So it's not going to break the bank either. And it's a Sedgefield Harriers handicap. So I might go and spectate. I'm not going to race. I'm not going to run. Maybe I should.
Oh. I know. Go for it. Shake off those cobwebs.
I'll be there either cheering people on or racing. I'm a t-shirt yet. We'll see. But yeah, good luck. Coming up. I'm blank. Okay.
So this is the time of the podcast when we always ask each other what's coming up, and we're both like, oh, it's blank.
It's blank. I'm literally got nothing.
What are we doing?
More of, well, this is, so tomorrow.
Will you? This is the big question on everyone's lips. Will you stay up to midnight on New Year's Eve?
Yes.
Will you?
Yeah. I won't be drinking. Oh, we'll have a drink. I've got an early shift. Over the Christmas period, we've kind of, my family basically can take turns doing what the carers do for my dad. So I've got the New Year's Day early shift to see that.
They're like, Gary, you'll be the only one not hungover. You go and...
yeah, I'm probably the least likely to drink locally anyway. So I've got that. So I can't get drunk. And I also fancy a New Year's Day park run early. So if I can get all my bits and bobs done in time, get over to Sedgefield or Durham. I think I've got a friend. He's a run streaker. And I think it might be... Oh, I can't remember what it is. He's ran every day for maybe a decade or something like that.
Where's the Durham Park Run?
I think it's Maiden Castle, you know, where the track is. I've never done it, but I think it's over that way. So yeah, there's a few things floating around. I will not be getting drunk. I might go do the park run just like socially. See people. Other than that, more 200s and 400s. I've got, 204, honestly, they kill me. And then it's these mile reps and then finishing off for 200s too. So I've got those next week. You know, it's really weird because I thought this training for 5K and 10K would be completely different to marathon training. But if, you know, five times a mile or something, that's still a big session. That's definitely going to give me some benefit. And I really like the fact that at the end of this five times a mile at threshold pace, you stick some 200s in there too, just to get your legs moving again at the end. I like, so I don't think doing this is going to have a negative effect on marathon training and stuff like that. So
no, yeah. I've actually done a lot of, with a lot of my athletes, didn't have a lot to do at the end of the year. We did a little 5K training block for whatever, yeah. You know, some of them were going off to do UTMB next year or something, but there's something to be said about putting that little speed injection into your training. Yeah. I think it will benefit you greatly, and it makes interesting content for us. And I can't wait till you go, oh, my hammies. After those
teams. Well, like I said, my legs, all of the running I did last year, hours and hours on the fells, apart from when the very first week I had DOMS after that first big, I think I did leg one on the Bob Graham round, and I was like, oh my goodness, I wasn't used to that. But the feeling I got after doing some 200s and 400s last night was completely different to anything I'd experienced since 2019. Which, yeah, you know, I'm carrying I'm about a stone heavier than I was back then, and 3 years older. So yeah, it's, but I'm looking forward to it. Good goals ahead for 2022. But yeah, what's your week look like?
Oh, I suppose I better start doing some proper training. I'm going to finish off this in the last few weeks with the kids at home and just this heavy ski load that they have. My middle one said to me, "So is that the end? Have we finished skiing now?" I was like, no, you've just done this like insane amount of skiing over Christmas and now you're going to go back to school for your little break. And so we're going to finish that off. I will carry on doing what I can do in that time. I have got the most mahoosive blisters on my feet from my ski boots.
Oh, yes.
Which I always get right at the beginning because it's just different. The skin is just not used to being in that from the trainer. It's just in contact in a different bit of the bit. So yeah. I've got peed all over my feet and I did. Bryn made me sleep one night without anything. I was like, let them dry, but I couldn't sleep because it was so painful that they were red raw. Ooh. Oh god. So I'm gonna try and do a few more little skis until I get like a 5-hour ski in the plan and I literally have no skin left on my feet. So I'm just gonna carry on.
You like chafe. You work your way around your body for different chafing.
This is worse than the chafing, the blister, especially on your feet, because you can't get away from it with the feet. And you know, like blisters when you're running, when you start running, they're a bit ouchy, but then they go. But in a ski boot, it like just doesn't, it's just constant because, I guess as well, you with a trainer, your foot moves all the time on the trail different way, but on a ski boot, it's just the same. You can't move the foot off the bit of pressure. It's just the pain. It's just that. So I'm going to harden those feet up. I've got to get back on my bike. I can't. I haven't been on my bike for like 6 weeks. Wow. I can't face it, Gary. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, well, I mean, that's just going to sit there in the podcast, not be mentioned.
It's going to be, we're all set up. Cassette ready, chains on. I've got my Zwift account. Thank you very much, Adriana, for my lovely gift.
It's a bribery gift, that. Like, get on it. Oh, I haven't had time to set out yet, Eddie. I'll not be on
I did
it
just
yet.
Go
I'll
on
just,
it.
I'll just do it for you. I'll do it for you.
I did it. I went on it and I got the app and I was just like riding along a road with loads of other randoms. I don't think I'm doing it right just yet and I need to get it to sync with Garmin.
We'll have to do
IT support
on it at the same time and I'll talk you through. It's not hard, Gary. Get a kid or get one of your kids to work it out. They'll be like,
I'm sure George could find his way around. It's interesting what you said about the pain and the blisters. Was it Brody Sharp said, I think I might have asked him, is there like a level of when you shouldn't run on a pain? And he was like, well, if you've got a blister, that could be like a 10 out of 10. But obviously, you know, that's not something.
They're proper blisters, proper. And this is, I'm talking like, I'm not talking like a small little, this is like that big.
Yeah.
It's this, and for those podcast listeners, that was the worst bit of content. But they're talking like 350p coins. Anyway, what am I doing? I'm just carrying on. I've got a few days less planless, so I'm just going to carry hardening myself off to get back into training and hoping. It's really raining. I haven't done anything today, and I might not do it. The rain is so bad.
I should have asked the question. And have you been for a run today?
No, and I don't think I'm going to, Gary, because... I can't run on the track. It's too wet. You'd be like knee deep potholing. Oh. The road is, why would you run on? If every time a car would come past, you'd be like puddles. I don't feel the need to do that today. So I might just watch Home Alone 2 and have a cup of tea. Guess what, Gary?
Go on in. Can't guess.
5-star reviews flooding in.
Oi, that's my bit.
Hey!
You threw me.
You thought I was going to tell you something really
different. Yeah, that was something else.
I got you. Got you, though.
You did, I told you. I'm so gullible.
Is this all one person's writing?
That's a lot of text.
Reread the whole thing. Come on. Well, it's a real. We're not going to do this all the time because I realised the last few podcasts we've read out bits about ourselves, which seems a bit... we love it. So it's our podcast. Let's read it. March 456. Great chemistry. Great guests and a great chat about a trail passion. They live and breathe. We do live and breathe. Perfect listening during a run. Eddie and Gary come across as just such lovely people with fantastic chemistry and a simply little rays of sunshine talking about a topic they're obviously passionate about. The interview guests are generally interesting with golden nuggets of info abound. And Eddie and Gary's various event stories and training tales are really useful when trying to plan your own race prep or training strategy, as well as often being hilarious. For me, a big part of the appeal, these are real people making time for this podcast around their own busy family lives with a relaxed non-studio atmosphere. That's very kind of that person to write. It's honest and down to earth, making it all the more relatable. Oh, thanks, March456, whoever you may be. Do pop along to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. They do make a big difference to the ratings. They keep us employed and we love reading them. We won't read out any more for a few weeks. We'll just keep our eye on them and copy and paste.
I promise that. I do like reading them out.
I stole reading out.
But I love it. I get my achy cheeks because when you know you read something that's positive.
I know, because so much in this world is, especially at the moment, the negativity.
Yeah.
I turned off my social media over Christmas for a few days. Oh, I turned it back on again today and I thought, you know, I could easily not have Facebook, Instagram. They don't really do a lot for me, really.
There's some important stuff on there, but generally speaking, yeah, it's not good. Especially now, have you noticed Facebook's like algorithms just seem to bombard you with adverts these days?
Oh, I scroll through it and I'm like, I don't have the app on my phone because it's a dangerous... tend to have it on my computer and you know, when I'm working, I'll have a little 5-minute look on Facebook. But yes, all adverts. I'm like, I remember when it used to be people posting stuff.
Yeah.
But now it's like, I'm not sure.
Guilty. I've placed adverts on Facebook, so I'm part of the problem too.
But some of the adverts as well, I'm like, oh, honestly, if I wanted a pair of period pants, I would have bought some by now. Why do I need to look at that every single time it flashes up?
Well, it's really clever. We liked a local Thai restaurant's Facebook page, or Lisa did on her Facebook, and then now she's flooded with like adverts to do with Thailand. It's really bizarre.
Well, we watched on Netflix with the kids, the Rubik's Cube, how to solve. There's a documentary about two boys that are like the world champions on Rubik's Cubers.
Okay, yeah.
And then suddenly on my Facebook came up loads of like how to. I was like, oh my God, it's listening.
But is that you think you're Alexa and then it's linked to Facebook?
No, it's all linked, the whole thing. It's a conspiracy.
Oh my goodness, don't start this. That was episode 70 of the Run to the Hills podcast. And I think that's the last one for 2022.
What a year. What a year we've had, Gary. Hasn't it flown past? How many hours do you think we've spent talking to each other on Zoom?
Oh, wow.
Oh. Mind-blowing statistic that would be, wouldn't it?
That's it. It's really bizarre that we've never actually met each other.
You think you'd recognize me? Like, if we walked down the street, you'd be like, oh, that's familiar.
I'd recognize you. But if you like the show, if you like to hear Eddie and I, Twitter Razor on.
Razor Sunshine, me being called.
It is, it's a wonderful, it's a Wednesday Zoom, so it's kind of knocked me off a bit. But I
did have
Zoom calls. If you like the show, please like, share and subscribe and give us a follow over on YouTube. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the 5-star reviews. And thanks to Chia Charge for their continued support with the show. My name's Gary Thwaites and Happy New Year, everybody.
Whoa, off the script. I'm Eddie Sutton. Happy New Year, everybody.
Let's run to the hills.